This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. As part of our series on radical change, we'll be talking in this program about medical reform. We'll have two guests, Norma Wilcox, who's leading efforts in our community to promote single-payer health care, and David Welch, a retired nurse from Enloe Hospital, who will discuss needed changes in the medical profession itself.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR listeners and by the COVID-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980.
The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Norma Wilcox about single-payer health insurance.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Who could heal your broken heart, analyze each bruise, and hear your story from the start, and stitch up every tiny tear with a ribbon and a bow, prescribe you some new medicine that makes you feel less alone. No, I am not a doctor, just an ordinary girl, but I know the way your chest aches, the way your head
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Tonight we're continuing our series of programs on radical change, inviting our guests to give us their views on the kinds of major reform that is needed in a time when the world as we know it is undergoing irreversible changes in culture, politics, and civility.
With us on the phone now is Norma Wilcox. She is the past president and treasurer of North State Medicare for All, formerly known as the Butte County, the Butte Healthcare Coalitions. And during the COVID-19 crisis, Norma has, among other things, been keeping our community apprised of developments in the pandemic and of resources for self and community care. She's been a frequent guest on Ecotopia and KZFR. We're pleased to have her express her views on radical reform of health care insurance. Welcome, Norma Wilcox.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Well, why do you, it may be a self-evident question, but why in you do you and so many others feel that our health insurance and health care system is broken beyond repair?
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic is exposing disparities between people of color and whites and low income and high income. And right now, black and brown people have three times the COVID-19 cases and are twice as likely to die compared to whites. In California, the Latinx and Hispanic population makes up 54% of the COVID cases, with 42% of the deaths and representing only 38% of the population. And in Butte County, Hispanics have 41% of the COVID cases, while being only 17.2% of the population. And for seniors of color, are much more likely to live with a school-age child compared to their white counterparts. And as the federal government is pushing for schools to open, this puts seniors, people of color, at a much higher risk of contracting COVID and dying. And for disparities in income, many lower-income people are classified as essential workers, and many have had to work with inadequate PPE protections and have no or little access to health care. And the last point is that we probably have been hearing about so many people losing their jobs and losing their health insurance. And when a person loses their financial livelihood at the same time as their healthcare access, it can cascade into a loss of home, car, resulting in homelessness, stress, despair, sickness, and death. And in May 2020, 27 million people had lost their health insurance, and this is on top of 27.9 million uninsured in 2018, resulting in approximately 54 million people without health insurance. And to put this into perspective, more people in the United States had no health insurance than the whole population of California at 39.5 million mm-hmm. people. So if we just imagine every single person in our state having no health insurance, you know, that's pretty drastic. And in great regards to bankruptcy, 66.5% of all bankruptcies, representing 530,000 families, file for bankruptcy each year because of medical bills.
We didn't have this on our list of preview questions, but what if you've if you're one of those 50 million without health insurance and you get COVID-19, what's it likely to cost you before you're through? We know you can get the testing for free, but if you have to go to the hospital, you're then on your own. Is that right?
Well, for most people, they are sent home, and they go through their COVID at home. And then if you have a lot of respiratory distress, then you will be admitted to the hospital and usually put in the ICU if hospitals have ICU beds. And as we're hearing, in the whole country, the ICU beds, you know, are being filled up. Mm-hmm. And financially, if you don't have any insurance, then you're billed. And I really don't know the amount, because it really depends on the number of days that you're in the intensive care unit.
Mm-hmm. And we know that those costs vary dramatically and radically. There's no consistent billing on such matters.
Right, yes. From hospital to hospital, it can vary.
There are lots of models for health insurance reform. What is Medicare for All single payer, and why do you support that?
Medicare for All is a single payer system that is universal, nonprofit, comprehensive, affordable, portable, which means you can take it from state to state, and it invests in the communities, especially communities in low-income areas, and is supported by 70% of Americans.
Mr. Biden and some others are calling for a public option rather than Medicare for All. What is your view of that?
Well, the Biden's public option plan would allow anyone to enroll. And the Biden's health care plan also allows anyone to stay on their private for profit plan. And so when they become unemployed, sick, or disabled, then they switch to the public plan. And what this does is it allows the private for-profit insurance companies to reap the profits off the young and healthy. And as soon as a person is needing expensive care, the insurance company can deny and delay care and push that sick person onto the public plan. And the only way to maintain high-quality comprehensive care is to have everyone in the pool to share the funds.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people can game the system, in fact, using Medicare, the public option, only if they're in desperate straits, and then they can't be turned down. So that runs the risk of deficit.
That's right, yes.
Biden also talks about it as an interim plan, and I must say personally I have mixed feelings about this. I personally want us to go to Medicare for all, but wonder if the public option might be a transition that would work. I
or
suspect
what it costs
that, or
church.
What it costs, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the public option plan, it depends on, how many go into the public option,
right,
and how sick they are. And also how many people continue on with their private for-profit plans. And I'm sure the insurance companies, who have lots of money, can entice, people to stay on their plan. And to put that into perspective, the United Healthcare Insurance Company for this last quarter posted $6.6 billion in their profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so those profits go to their CEOs and their executives and their shareholders. And what it does is that increases the wealth of that group.
Right.
And most of them are white. And so it really continues to create much more disparity in wealth between white and people of color.
So how would the finances work if we had no private insurance companies? How would the money flow be different?
Well, right now, 71% of the money is already paid through taxes that we already have.
Okay.
That goes into the federal government, and it pays for, a variety of programs that we have. And so for the rest of that, it would be a payroll tax that would be like we have with Medicare. So when you get your monthly check or your every 2 weeks, there's a certain amount that is taken out for your Medicare.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And we're on Medicare. We pay $113 a month, which is way less than we were paying the private insurance people when we were on our employer's plan.
Yes, and the Medicare plays 80%, and the the supplemental, the
right,
for profit, pays 20%. So they're doing very, very well financially.
Mm-hmm. People have said also there would be room for private insurance to be in on the supplemental plans. That is, Medicare for all would not necessarily cover everything, so the private insurance companies could still get their cut by offering supplemental plans.
Well, the enhanced Medicare for All, the current Medicare for All, the Jay Appel bill and the Bernie Sanders bill, that covers 100%.
I didn't realize that.
It does. And so for seniors, it really, really is a big improvement because you don't have to pay all that money for your 20%.
Right.
Plus, it covers your vision and your dental and your hearing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a huge, because each of those supplemental plans is another chunk of money.
That's right.
So
right, and it keeps going up every year that you get older.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yep.
For the 20%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, North State Medicare for All and people all over the globe are arguing that health insurance, health coverage, health care is a human right. Could you explain the arguments for that, please?
Well, in 1965, Medicare integrated hospitals and doctors' offices by paying only those who integrated people of color into their services. And all the hospitals and all the doctors' offices and all the clinics wanted that money, and they integrated throughout the whole country. So the whole country integrated at the same time. And we need a real change in our belief system, because right now is many believe that healthcare is a privilege for the moneyed class, to healthcare is a human right. Mm-hmm. And in a public emergency, which we're experiencing right now, mm-hmm. all persons are only as healthy as those who are most vulnerable, least economically secure, and least covered by our social services.
So even if you're wealthy, there is a bottom line, a lowest common denominator, which means that the vulnerable people, are part of the whole package.
It is, and if you're a billionaire and you're in a store with somebody who has got COVID, and mm-hmm. and the day before you develop symptoms is when the virus is most virulent, right. and they feel healthy. Right. Then that billionaire can catch that virus, and it would cost a lot less if that money was available to test the most vulnerable.
Right.
And so the billionaire would be protected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
So what will it take to get Medicare for all? I mean, we have seen over and over again the catastrophic expenses of various kinds of diseases, but now with COVID-19, will things change quickly if we get a new president, or if the hospitals collapse, or if we get a democratically controlled Congress? And can California do it alone?
Well, let me speak about California first.
Okay.
In California, there's one thing here is California needs to pass Proposition 15, which is the schools and community first proposition, that would close commercial property tax loopholes that big corporations and wealthy investors use to avoid paying their fair share of property taxes, mm-hmm. to reclaim $12 billion, that's $12 billion,
yeah.
dollars per year for schools, community colleges, and local communities such as healthcare services.
Wow.
And that's huge, and
huge.
We really need that money.
Yeah.
And deserve it. The other part is Governor Newsom needs a recommendation for a single-payer bill from the Healthy California for All Commission. And Governor Newsom created the Healthy California for All Commission to develop a plan for advancing progress toward achieving a healthcare delivery system for California that provides coverage and access through a unified financing system, including but not limited to a single-payer financing system. And on this commission, there are 13 voting members, and we've got three strong Medicare for All supporters with a fourth on the fence. And they are mandated to complete their work by February 1, 2021.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's going to happen now with COVID. It's
right.
been backed along a little bit. But there have been over 300 people from the public from all over the state participating on the Zoom meetings, writing in many messages in the chat box, with most all supporting Medicare for All.
Mm.
And the amount of input has created changes in the commission's strategies of largely involving the big corporate representation and leaving out underserved representation,
right.
to allow more diverse voices. So, it's a David and Goliath story, but we've been dealing with that for over 100 years. we're all hanging in there, and
yeah.
We're making some changes. And then on the national level, we do need a Democratic-controlled Senate and House of Representatives.
Yeah.
We need a president who will support and join and sign the bill. We need a critical mass of public support for Medicare for All, which we have. We have 70% now.
Wow.
And we need a critical mass to disinvest in private health insurance companies. And money talks, and that's you know, what will make some changes. So those are the main things that I see that we need to get it.
So what do people do to disinvest? Do they just not have health care, or do they, you know, what do you do?
Well, it depends on how you're invested. Are you invested personally as an individual with buying stock in that company? So that's pretty easy to shift your money somewhere else. Or if it's in a mutual fund or some kind of a group, then basically it's communicating with the other stakeholders at your annual meetings of how you want to shift the funds to something else other than private for-profit health insurance companies.
Right.
Norma Wilcox, you and others in your group have linked single payer to other societal needs. It's a very broad view. Housing, food, education, job training, even a healthy planet. Could you explain that, please?
Yes. What we need is a guaranteed health care system, you know, a Medicare for all single payer. And I really stress the word guaranteed. Because, you know, us who have Medicare, we know that regardless of if we're healthy or sick, you know, we're taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And also, health really depends on continuous long-term housing, healthy accessible food, and affordable education for job training. And long-term housing, permanent housing, stable housing, you know, is so, so important. I mean, you cannot be healthy when you're totally stressed and living on the streets. You just can't.
Yeah.
And the third point is to provide all the necessary elements for health of humans. The environment needs to be healthy for its plants, animals, water, and air.
Yes, absolutely. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Norma, it's been really helpful to have you here. Thank you so much, Norma Wilcox, for being with us tonight.
I'd just like to say how people can get involved.
Yes, okay. Please, I'm so sorry.
We skipped over that.
We have
a website.
www.northstatemedicare4all.org. And the Facebook, which is updated frequently, is North State Medicare 4all. And the phone number is 530-636-0199. And I'll just repeat that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
530-636-0199.
And we will post that on our website and in our resources page, which is also a part of our website. Norma, thank you so much. I always fear when we get you on, we don't give you enough time because you know so much more than we're able to do in 25 minutes. We need to get you back more frequently. And hopefully, with an election coming up in November, we can talk a little bit more about the possibilities with a new administration, a new Senate, and continuing power in the House of Representatives. So thank you very much for being with us tonight. Again,
yes, you're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll take a short break now and be back to talk with David Welch about radical reform within the medical profession. Oops, sorry.
Hospital bed.
Mm-hmm.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're talking about radical change in our healthcare system. We've heard from Norma Wilcox about single payer and reforming health insurance. Now on the phone with us is David Welch, who has recently retired after a 36-year career as a registered nurse and an activist in both nursing labor issues and broader concerns of the North State Labor Federation. Welcome, David Welch.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Good.
David, you sent us some notes on your major concerns about the medical profession, so let's plunge right in. The first on your list was medical education. Tell us what your concerns are there and how we can reform it.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was done. Just
go.
We're cutting loose in this show, so no holds barred. If you want to abolish med schools and offer something else, it's okay with us.
No, actually, it's more that when you look at most of developed countries, let me back off one step first and say, you know, sort of going up with what Norma was talking about, single-payer health care by itself, I'm a huge advocate for that, itself, it doesn't solve all the problems with our health care. But it makes all of the problems easier to solve. It aligns the incentives and it creates a situation where all of the other problems that we have to do become easier to solve when we get a single-payer type frame. But medical education, one of the things that I'm in, is tremendously expensive in America and surprisingly scarce. Even though we are a rich country, we don't own all of the physicians that we need, and the ones that we do train come out of school often with staggering amounts of medical debt. So there's sort of two consequences that come from that. One is that because we aren't training all the physicians we need, we are often essentially stealing doctors away from much poorer countries invested in them. And from a sort of a basic decent equity standpoint, it seems like a really sad that we're taking physicians away, we're enticing them away from places like India, for example, and so on, invest their scarce resources in training physicians. But also, because our medical education is so expensive for physicians, it tends to create a situation where they're strongly incentivized to go into the high-tech procedural special medicine. And look at the effect of health care on population expectancy and population well-being. Now, the high-tech parts of medicine, the really advanced modern tech parts that are the glamorous parts, you know, whether it's heart surgery, kidney dialysis, those kinds of things, can be immensely important to one individual. But what really makes a difference to the population, what affects population life expectancy, policy, it's access to primary care. That's really the only part of the healthcare system that has much effect on life expectancy. Other things like access to clean water and good food have a big effect on life expectancy. But as far as the healthcare system is concerned, it's really only the access to primary care that makes a big difference in that respect. Mm-hmm. And so I think our system now strongly incentivizes doctors to go into those high-tech procedural specialties because they're paid so poorly in doing primary care. Mm-hmm. We underpay primary care and overpay, relatively speaking, those procedural specialties. And that means, as a result, we get not enough primary care, poor access to primary care, and way too much of those high-tech procedural kinds of things.
I just have a question about, to go back to who goes to medical school and the expense of it. Does it discourage people of color from going to med school? Do we poorer people, perhaps, I think it's both race and class that can be discouraged by that kind of debt?
Yes, because they're much less likely to have either the willingness or the ability to take on those massive amounts of debt. So
right.
It needs to affect who goes into healthcare for sure. The again, you look by comparison at the system that I have some little bit of familiarity with, which is the French healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, their payment system and so on is structured very differently than ours, but their medical education is essentially free. It's demanding to get into, as it should be. The
mm-hmm.
standards should be high for getting mm-hmm. into medical school, but if you meet those standards, it's essentially free to go through
mm-hmm.
that education, as it is in Canada and as it is in many of the other countries that have single payer or similar to single mm-hmm. payer type systems.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about the primary care physicians again? If you have it off the top of your head, what does a primary care physician make?
I don't have this off the top of my head, but probably if I was going to make a rough guess, the typical this is extrapolating from numbers that were good a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
I would suspect that a typical primary care physician makes maybe something on the order of $120,000 a year, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more than that, which obviously is far from poverty.
Yeah.
But, you compare that to a surgeon or radiologist or some of those specialties that might easily make four times that much.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you're coming out of school with $250,000 in debt, the incentive is pretty strong there to look at one of those higher paying high tech specialties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In our lifetimes, we've gone from the family GP of our childhood. When my mother was sick, we called the doctor and he came to our house and she had appendicitis and he got her to the hospital quickly. But anyhow, we had house calls in my day for various kinds of things. Now we're almost in factory style family practices with multiple practitioner specialties and even factory style hospitals. So what has been the price of this efficiency and how do we do something about it? How do we fix it?
Yeah, it's a I think that it a lot of it again it all comes back again to, in many ways, the logic of a healthcare system is the logic of business, then the imperatives of business and the logic of business tends to infect every part of the healthcare system. And that then means what you want to do is what is most efficient defined as financially efficient defined as what produces the best bottom line, as opposed to what is best for patients. So we have this very mixed healthcare delivery system. For example, we have for-profit hospitals, we have not-for-profit hospitals, we have public hospitals. But because so much of the system, so much of our healthcare system is based on business, and the logic of the system is the logic of business, even the nonprofit and public parts of the system often tend to operate like the for-profit parts of the system, because all of that drives that logic. So we have, for example, nonprofit hospital chains. Nonprofit meaning that they're supposed to exist, provide a service for the public, but where the top executives of those chains are being paid several million dollars a year,
right,
would be the case, for example, in the Kaiser system or the Sutter healthcare system are examples of that, where a great deal of money goes to top executives in those systems, and where those systems have a very large, you know, what most of us would think of as profit, though in a nonprofit system they call that operating margin or something like that.
Right.
And where their logic becomes, again, not the logic of service, but the logic of business. And when you think about public hospitals in the places where they exist, as they do in many places, you'll often see a newspaper headline about the public hospital is losing money. Well, the public hospital is a public service that exists to provide a public good, a public need, and we don't talk about our fire department losing money or our road department losing money, but we expect our public hospital to be profitable. And so it again, it's that way in which the logic of business infects everything else.
Mm-hmm. So I want to know a little bit about how that was like for you as a nurse, and for what you observed. What kinds of settings were you in, and how did that kind of profit motive and need for efficiency affect the work of the people you worked with?
Well, it certainly is. You observe. We saw a real change back in the 90s. This was probably the most dramatic change, where, you know, at our local hospital here, Enloe Hospital, that had been is a not-for-profit hospital, a non-profit community hospital, and had been under the same top management since it became non-profit. It was originally founded as a proprietary hospital owned by one man, and then when Dr. Enloe died, a community nonprofit corporation was formed to buy the hospital from his heirs, and it became a nonprofit hospital, had roughly the same top leadership for almost 30 years. And then when new leadership came on board that came from a for-profit hospital chain, we saw this dramatic change, and a dramatic change in favor of much more focus on the bottom line. And I think the most striking moment in that was literally where our hospital CEO told us that the community and the nurses were going to have to get used to a lower standard of care because we couldn't afford to provide as good a standard of care as we had been accustomed to. And it was really that moment, perhaps more than any other, that drove us to unionize nurses at the hospital.
Yeah, right.
And in fact, I have to say that while, you know, I have serious disagreements with them many times, I think since then there has been something of a change for the better management there. And while we still, you know, from the nursing standpoint and the union standpoint, we still had disagreements with them quite often about priorities up until the time I left. It got a good deal better than that situation we had from about the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, where it was really at a low point in there.
Right.
And things have improved. One of the things I have to say is that we see again, one of those big trends, big changes that's happened in hospitals has been consolidation, where it's been more difficult for independent community-based hospitals to survive. That has led to more of them either being bought up by for-profit chains, or in some cases by big nonprofit chains that often act like for-profits. And once that happens, you have a loss of connection to the community and something of a change in priorities. And so I'm actually really glad that our local hospital has been able to remain independent and has been determined to remain independent and not let itself be bought up by some kind of entity from outside. So I think that's been a plus for us, because it keeps that close. One of the classic examples that we see as a contrast, there's a requirement, really, that as a nonprofit hospitals, of course, don't pay any taxes. They don't pay property taxes. They don't pay, you know, basically they don't pay any taxes.
Right.
And a condition of that, like other nonprofits, is that they are supposed to exist to serve the public and that they are expected to provide a certain amount of, for example, charity care, care to people who are unable to pay and things like that. That's their reason for existence, is to serve a community need.
Mm-hmm.
And the big nonprofit chains really tend to game that system. And so they'll do what they call an educational program, for example, that really is more advertising than it is education, mm-hmm. and they count this as part of their public benefit that they're supposed to do. And they oftentimes are not very generous about providing that charity care to people who are unable to pay, while quite often the independent community hospital that is more closely connected to its community and has a board of directors that's connected to the community often does do a better job of doing that.
So
I think that consolidation in the hospital system, the loss of independent hospitals, has been one of the big negatives. And I would love to see, again, I think with a single payer system, we can turn some of that around and we can help these independent hospitals to survive by paying more equitably for some of those things.
So are there any sort of guidelines or any sort of rules or laws or anything that govern what kind of community service nonprofit hospitals do? It's just what they think?
There's a little bit of movement in that direction. I don't remember exactly where that stands, but been one of the things that our nurses union, the California Nurses Association, really worked hard at, is to try and get standards passed for that. And I think there has been some progress, been a little out of touch with that, but I think there's been some progress, but needs to be a lot more in setting clear standards. How much of a hospital's bottom line should be put towards community service, and what should count as community service?
You know, another trend that I've noticed, and you could talk more about this, is the emergence of nurse practitioners as having an important role in your care. And frankly, I like my nurse practitioner way more than my doctor. She spends more time with me. She talks to me more. She asks me questions and lets me ask questions. And so what is that? I mean, it might be a movement for, you know, greater efficiency or something, but for me, it's a more movement toward a more humane kind of care.
Yeah, I think it often can, and I think that particularly when a nurse practitioner has the right experience and has the right background coming into it and the right mentoring as they begin, I think nurse practitioners can actually do a wonderful job of primary care. And in a way, it's how we've filled some of the gaps in our primary care system, from not training enough primary care physicians, so the nurse practitioners are gradually filling a bigger and bigger role. And indeed, they can do a wonderful job if they're the right person coming into that role and have the right experience. I do a little bit worry sometimes about some of the younger nurse practitioners who come out of nursing school, work for a year or two as an RN, and then go to school to become nurse practitioners. Mm-hmm. I would actually kind of prefer that they had a little more experience, some of them, before they do that. But I think that if they've been through the right program, if they have the right mentoring, and they know what their appropriate limitations are, I've certainly seen lots of them that do a very good job.
You talked a little bit earlier about how Medicare for All could help to regulate prices and costs. I wonder if you could go into that in a little more detail. Would the specialist who's now pulling down $650,000 a year see his or her income drop? Would the GP see an increase? Would we have across the board regulated prices?
Yeah, it's not necessarily automatically so. It depends on what the people governing the system decided to do. But personally, I think it would make sense to redress some of that balance. I think to increase the reimbursement rates for time spent in the office talking to patients, which right now pays very poorly, but often has big returns. I think to increase some of the payment for that and decrease a little bit the payment for some of the procedural stuff, some of the surgical type things and things like that. My own doctor pointed out to me one day that, as a general practitioner, he'll do various minor little procedures like freezing off a actinic keratosis, the so-called precancerous lesion, and points out that he gets paid more for doing that little procedure in 2 minutes than he does for 15 minutes of talking to the patient. And talking to the patient and listening to their concerns and counseling them about taking care of themselves and so on can be a pretty valuable healthcare that I think is often undervalued.
And the same way with my dermatologist, the nurse practitioner does everything. I see him only when there's a procedure that requires cutting. Right. She does even the freezing stuff. So it just seems like there's a much greater role. So what do you with your union work, you've been advocating for nurses. What changes do you propose to correct deficiencies in the nursing side of healthcare? What needs to happen to improve?
Nationwide, California still remains the only state in the nation where we have a set numerical standard for nurse-to-patient ratios and how many patients a nurse can be required to care for. And all the other states do not have a clear set standard for that. And it's very clear that that has made a difference in survival, made a difference in complications, so on. And that's thing that needs to be much more widespread, that needs to be taken as a national standard across the country. And I think that would make a tremendous difference. There are multiple that, for example, this was a number of years ago, but it was looking at post-surgical patients, and the of this large study was that every additional patient in the nurse's workload increased the post-surgical death rate by 7%.
Oh my gosh, that's huge.
And so that really is an example of we need to have an optimal workload for nurses. And in reality, what that means much of the time is it means strong enough unions for nurses not only to help pass laws about that, but also to help make sure those laws are enforced properly.
Is that very common outside of California, that there are strong unions?
Not nearly common enough. Mm-hmm. Many states, there is no unionization in nursing. And, of course, in the southern states in particular, and the places where there are strong unions in nursing are mostly the Northeast and the West Coast, and so those are the places where you have the biggest impact. I think just everything that happens to give nurses more of a voice in their care and give the people who are delivering the care the strongest possible voice in that process really makes a very positive.
We talked with Norma a bit about potential change of regimes come November with the election. And we know from past conversations with you that you're likely looking forward to a change in the presidency. If you could blue sky a little bit, there's a lot of talk about Biden and a first 100 days, or possibility that the Democrats might take the Senate, in which case the loggerhead would be broken. What would you like to see happen in that golden era of those first 100 days vis-a-vis health care?
Well, I mean, in my optimum dreams, of course, the Pramila Jayapal and Bernie Sanders bills I would love to see passed. Mm-hmm. I think the likelihood, with so much going on and so much need, that we would actually be able to move that forward quickly is probably not that good. But that's what ideally should happen. I would like, you know, people talk about gradual transitions to Medicare for All, and I think many of them, like the public option viewed as a gradual transition, is not really a step in the right direction for all the reasons that Norma talked mm-hmm. about, that the insurance companies managed to game that system so well. I think if we were going to do something of a gradual transition, what I would personally like to see is something like closing in on it from the ends. The people who have the hardest time getting insured are often the young people just out of school, taking often low-wage jobs and things like that. And mm-hmm. then it's the people in the last 5 or 10 years before Medicare age, the people in their late 50s and early 60s, who often have the hardest time getting coverage, because they have, you know, they're the most likely to for example, lose a job and have a hard time getting another one and things like that, and or having to lose a job and have to take a lower level job that doesn't provide health coverage. And so I think if people wanted to do something gradual, that's the way I would like to see it happen, is okay, let's start off by covering everybody under 25 and over 55, and then every year we'll move 5 years closer to the middle. Mm-hmm. And we've got everybody covered, something like that.
Yeah.
That would be a sort of a reasonable way of making the transition somewhat gradual.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard about the idea of doing the younger one. That makes sense, because they're still pretty healthy, but get them in the system mm-hmm. contributing to it while we oldsters continue to draw heavily on it.
yes, which is indeed often true. But and the thing that doesn't get nearly talked about enough, but clearly people talk about, okay, the cost of a single payer system, but it's not more expensive than what we're doing now. It's less expensive than what we're doing now. It's just a question of how that expense is being paid. When you look at the total expenditures on health care, our expenditure per capita is so much higher than the countries that have single-payer or similar to single-payer systems. And the French healthcare system, for example, which clearly produces distinctly better results than ours, and yet their cost per capita is somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of ours.
We have personal experience with that too. Susan was sick in Paris, went to the hospital three times, and we had to pay $70 out of pocket
for medication, for seeing doctors.
That was it.
Getting tests.
We actually, in our family, had a similar experience being over there. Had to access their healthcare system, so that made me a little more, much more interested and much more aware of that system, because it worked so very well.
Mm-hmm. Any closing thoughts, David? Any other items on your wish list that we can mention? We just have a minute or so left.
There are so many. And let's just take one example. One of the things that people often talk about so much is the cost of prescription drugs. And people come up with all sorts of various systems to try and improve that. But the reality is, once you have a single payer system, you have a single purchaser for prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. And that single purchaser can essentially determine what the price will be. So instead of having all of these drug companies able to charge really shocking amounts of money, often for drugs that have been developed by taxpayer-funded research institutions and then turned over to the for-profit companies to make money off of, if the In a single-payer system, you sort of immediately fix that problem of the cost of prescription drugs because you can set a reasonable price that allows those companies to make a fair profit but not to make absurd profits off of medications.
Yeah.
So that would be one of the areas, again, like I said, that single-payer system doesn't fix everything, but it's easier to fix everything.
So we've been talking with David Welch. David was 36 years a nurse and is now retired, but is, I think, still involved in making good things happen. So thank you so much for being on Ecotopia. It was a pleasure to have you.
All right. You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Good. Thank you, David.
Sorry.
That's not the virus, is it?
No, I don't have the virus.
Okay. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Coming up at 7 this evening, it's Radioactive with Ginger Nichols, who is now in the house. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs. We also have our ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. And as we've mentioned, we are now podcasting. I don't have those links up yet, but they will be on the website tomorrow, and you can click into the podcast provider of your choice if you're not available on Tuesday evenings between 5 and 6 p.m. Within 24 hours, your podcast people will deliver you a recording of tonight's show. And also, as we've said in this show, this series of programs on radical reform, we really welcome suggestions and people who'd like to come on the air with radical proposals for change. What we're pushing for in this series of programs is we all know the realities, we all know how difficult it is to make change, but we have to keep in mind the vision, the big vision toward which we want to work, and that's what radical form would be all about. So, if you're of a mind to, send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to Ecotopia.
Good night.
Chemical.